Hello, and welcome to Runway Girl Network in Conversation, a deep dive into aviation and the passenger experience. I'm RGN Deputy Editor John Walton, and today I'm in conversation with aviation journalist Gesha Vupa, joining me from Paris today. With a lot of news in European aviation this month, we're talking about Air France, June, Flybe, drones and Brexit, and we will try to cover it all. But first, thanks to our sponsor. In Conversation is brought to you by Bolteron, a Simona company, purveyor of high-performance thermoplastics for tomorrow's aircraft interiors. Specialising in an extensive range of film and sheet products tailored to the requirements of the aerospace industry, Bolteron is dedicated to providing consistent, high-quality materials, advanced performance solutions, and meeting evolving trends in aircraft interior design. Learn more at boltaron.com. Now, Gesha, for those of our listeners who don't know you, why don't you introduce yourself?
Yes, hi, John. So first of all, thank you very much for joining, have me join in here. And I'm based in Paris and since already 16 years now. And I work as a business correspondent for German daily Die Welt and for the financial newspaper Börsenzeitung. And one of my main topics is the aviation industry, as it's very, very important for the French economy. And I love it, in fact. So I write a lot about Airbus and regularly about Air France as well. And I'm also a member of the French Aviation Journalist Association, AGPAE, where we regularly have people like CEOs from companies, from the aviation sector, or other experts.
Fantastic. Well, this year in European aviation certainly seems to have started as it finished. Small airlines continuing to go bust or to be absorbed into bigger ones, drones closing major London airports, and of course the huge uncertainty about the impact of Brexit. A very happy new year to us all. Let's start with airlines. The latest breaking news today is that Virgin Atlantic will be returning to domestic and European flights with its plan to buy Flybe. In conjunction with its partners Stobart Air, which many may know as Air Iran. It operates regional flights on ATRs and Embraer E-Jets for, if memory serves, Aer Lingus, Flybe and British Airways, together with the Cirrus Capital Partners. Now, the deal is valued at, frankly, astounding £2.2 million. That's million with an M. I'm pretty sure that the planes that they have are worth more than that. Gesha, what's your take on this takeover?
Yeah, like you said, it's a very astonishing price. It's quite cheap, at least it seems to be, because that means they will only pay 1 pence per stock, per share, and that's a discount I read of about 94% of the last closing price of Flybe stocks on Thursday. But on the other hand, then I think they will inject some money into it. And I read it was about £20 million to provide liquidity. So it's not only the price, it's also the investments they will make.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's going to be really interesting to see Virgin re-entering this market, because the signs are that they're going to be operating it with a Virgin branded, Virgin marketed carrier that we assume at this point is called Virgin Atlantic. Now, of course, the last time that Virgin tried that was with Little Red, which was its Aer Lingus operated A320 family. I believe they had A320s and not just A319s out of Heathrow, and that was the basis of that was, if memory serves, remedial slots coming off from British Airways' purchase of BMI. Earlier this decade, and Virgin couldn't make it work then, so it'll be interesting to see whether they make it work now. Not so much for the Heathrow slots. I mean, Flybe has a few slots here and there operating domestically within the UK up to Scotland. You know, not in fairness that a sub 100 seater jet is the best use of a London Heathrow slot, but there you go. But I think it's going to be really interesting to see how Virgin uses that to drive connectivity outside Heathrow. Particularly at airports like Gatwick and Manchester and Glasgow. It already has a partnership, of course, with EasyJet to do just that. So it'll be really interesting for me to see how those, because Flybe and EasyJet overlap on a number of routes. It'll be really interesting to see how that partnership and those passenger flows change over time.
And what do you think about the them? They want to rename Flybe into Virgin Atlantic. What do you think about that? Because Flybe is really a very well-known brand, no? Isn't it?
But it's not necessarily well known for good. I end up flying Flybe relatively frequently. They're one of the airlines that will get me to bits of the UK that aren't Heathrow, from here in Lyon. It's been on the decline, Gesher. I flew on Flybe back for Christmas to visit my folks, and it was the worst flight of the year. Which is impressive because there's not a lot of time that you have in the, hour and a half from Lyon to London. But it was a variety of things. It was just the sort of cabin crew who just really weren't interested in being there. It's the sort of bored sounding announcements. It's the cabin crew are here for your safety, and then we'll also try and sell you things. Not in quite as many words, but almost. And then on arrival, it was bizarre. We landed in Birmingham and were held at our gate. Well, not a gate, it's a hard stand, and prevented from disembarking. And the only reason I know that was what it was because I heard the flight attendant literally shouting out of the door at the ground service personnel how cross she was that this was happening again, and it happens every week, and she was fed up of apologizing to passengers. So anyone who wasn't within shouting distance of the door didn't really hear anything of that. Everyone was just standing in the aisles, and we could have been told to sit back down because it's going to be a 20-minute wait, but no. So it was just a bit, the Birmingham passenger experience is a bit shonky anyway, but it's the kind of thing where you walk down the steps literally right next to a jet bridge. And then you walk up the steps that are attached to the jet bridge, rather than just moving the jet bridge. And I realise that you have to have a jet bridge operator to do that, and that's a cost. But it just felt a bit, it just stuck in the old craw a little bit there. What's your take on the branding situation?
Yeah, I thought that Flybe is really very well known, but on the other hand, I can understand that they want to use the Virgin Atlantic brand if they want to use it as a, to feed their other flights. And I mean, it makes sense.
I mean, do you ever fly it out of Paris?
No, sorry, I
Yeah,
didn't.
yeah. I
I
mean,
think a long, long, long time ago I flew with Flybe, but it's years ago. So
yeah. I mean,
normally, I use when I go back to Germany, I use in general, I use Air France.
It's interesting because Flybe and Air France had a relatively strong partnership as well. So it'll be interesting to see how that develops. Particularly in the context of Delta, which of course is the controlling owner essentially of Virgin Atlantic. It'll be interesting. But of course we can't forget the UK perspective here in terms of the Virgin brand, which is largely positive but diminishing over recent years. Not necessarily Virgin Atlantic, but other parts of the Virgin family. I mean, you had the East Coast train operator, up the East Coast mainline, Virgin Trains East Coast, which essentially gave back its franchise to run the trains because it couldn't make any money. And they've also been catching flak for their operations in the private healthcare sector. People in the UK are very fond of the National Health Service in particular, and the work that Virgin has been doing has not been getting particularly positive press. People feel that they're taking too much money out of the health service and not giving enough back, and it's so it's been really interesting to see from a wider Virgin point of view how this brand does, and indeed how you manage to inject some of that Virgin Atlantic glam into what are essentially very unglamorous turboprops and small Embraer E-jets, flying on an hour, couple hour flights. It'll be interesting to see how that what's possible there. Now, what's your take, Gesha, on whether Christine Umiales-Widner will continue to be a part of the new Flybe or the new Virgin Atlantic?
Oh, I think it's too early to say, really. So I won't take a bet.
No, fair enough. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, there are so few women CEOs that it'll be very interesting to see where she lands, whether she stays at Flybe slash Virgin Atlantic, or whether she takes off for pastures new, as it were. Yeah, the ownership of this new airline, this new subsidiary, I believe it's called the Connect Airways Partnership, Connect Airways Limited or something, is going to be 30% Virgin Atlantic, 30% Stobart Group, best known for their lorries, strangely, but will also absorb Stobart Airways into this new group. Plus Cyrus, the what is it? Is a hedge fund, if memory serves. So that'll be really interesting to see how that works, particularly given that Delta will obviously be a player there. Delta itself has been dipping its toe into expanding operations in the UK, and of course with the question of Brexit, it'll be interesting to see how much the UK can be a transit point for the US for a lot of the passengers and a lot of the routes that they're looking at here. It'd be interesting to see also whether Stobart Air continues to operate for Aer Lingus, which is of course in the IAG stable with British Airways. There aren't a huge number of these smaller airlines operating ATRs and so on that have the ability to do that for Aer Lingus. So it'll be interesting to see what they end up with.
That's absolutely right. Yes, I think it's very fascinating.
It'll certainly get some column inches out of that one. Now, speaking of small airlines disappearing, Joon, everybody's favourite rooftop bar, the airline for millennials, or the Air France testing laboratory, whichever one of the many marketing lines you believe, will be reabsorbed into Air France. New Air France KLM CEO Benjamin Smith has announced. Now, this came in the context of the announcement that they have secured an agreement with the flight attendant unions, which is, of course, a huge part of the wider problem with Air France in terms of profitability, in terms of transformation of the legacy carrier into a more nimble, more modern operation. It is interesting to see this June disappear.
That's right. But on the other hand side, I think it makes sense because it was really, I mean, Air France, they were too late maybe with a real low-cost airline. And on the other hand, when they announced Joon, they didn't want it to be a real low-cost airline. They said, okay, it's not as pricey as Air France, but it's not a low-cost airline. So that was quite bizarre as a positioning, I think. And on the other hand side, I can also understand Ben Smith, who apparently says there are too many brands already with Air France because you have Air France KLM, because you have Air France, bien sûr, you have KLM, and then you have the French regional airline, which is called HOP, and then you have Transavia, the low-cost airline
Yeah, which
as well.
operates in both France and the Netherlands.
Yeah, and started in the Netherlands. I mean, it's much more active in the Netherlands than in France because of as you know, because of the trade unions here in France. So I think he's right, maybe to say, okay, maybe too many different brands, and we have to be a bit more clear. And apparently he wants to now to position Air France again as a like a luxury brand, and because the former CEO of Air France KLM, Alexandre de Juniac, who also was counting on the fact that Air France stands for the l'art de vivre, à la française and the gastronomy and all these things,
Je ne sais quoi, we could even say, yes.
Yeah, so apparently he wants to do this again, to position it really as more luxury and as a French lifestyle brand.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I support that as the best way forward for Air France. I mean, obviously France has and particularly Air France has very strong unions, and that's by and large a good thing for employees, of course. But it has meant that the airline has not been able to cut costs as significantly as with other airlines. June, of course, was this very strange thing where the pilots were regular old Air France pilots just flying planes with a different livery, but the cabin crew were running around in sneakers and sweaters and just looking a little bit, trying to be too cool for school. That if and really the only change was business class on some routes like Lisbon didn't get a hot meal, they got a cold meal. But basically everything else was still Air France, and so there wasn't really a. I mean, people didn't have a choice. I mean, what was happening? The entire routes were just getting handed over to June lock stock. And of course, airlines are very bad at branding. Jason Rabinowitz was talking about he and his folks met somebody on holiday when they were in South Africa who thought that the passenger thought they were flying Delta from South Africa to Paris, but it wasn't Delta, it wasn't even Air France, it was June.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, so it's like operated by June by Air France, no, by June for Air France for Delta. It was one of those really complicated sort of nested passenger experience situations, which I'm just skeptical of those. It doesn't strike me as a good way to set the right expectations with your passengers. But I think that Air France has the opportunity to go luxurious. La Première, their first class, is of course still excellent. They have one of the most renowned ground services in the world, if not the most renowned. That they've got a fantastic restaurant, a lovely lounge, car transfers. The seats are, if not, they're not exactly overwhelming in their luxury. I'm not entirely convinced by this sort of pull across polyester curtain situation. But there's a decent there's still a decent market for first class there. Business class, obviously have been upgrading their seats recently. They've got a lot of Zodiac Cirrus, and they like Finnair have been quite smart in taking a relatively bare bones version, which exhibits fewer of the quality and production issues that Cirrus has been facing. And they're also taking for the for their more leisure routes, they're going to be taking Zodiac Optima, which is of course the base product for the United Polaris seat. Because Air France has this subset of routes which are very much visiting friends and relatives, holiday routes. You're looking at places like to the French Caribbean, to Réunion, across Pacific to Tahiti and to New Caledonia. That sort of long haul but low yielding market. If not low cost, which of course they have significant competition on already.
But speaking about the seats, apparently, according to La Tribune, Ben Smith sent a letter to staff, and he told them that he also wants to simplify the configurations of the planes, because he says. Apparently, he says that there are different planes, on the same long haul routes with different configurations in the cabins. And apparently, he wants to also to simplify this and to put on more premium first class, business class, and premium economy seats on the long haul.
Which would make a lot of sense. Obviously Air France had the well had slash has the A380 as its flagship notionally, but its business class is terrible. I mean, it has those awful old angled lie-flat seats, which are at least 20, well, they're exactly 20 years out of date this year. The Virgin Atlantic J2000 seat debuted then, and next year it'll be 20 years since the British Airways' first fully flatbed in business class. So those are well past their time. So I think that article in La Tribune, I do take it with a pinch of salt. I think that he's flagging some things internally around the requirements that he's going to be wanting for the cabin crew in terms of service standards and service quality. Well, he is obviously also talking about, literal seats. And that the A380 is essentially the one there that I think makes the most sense to look at very strongly. There is no reason why those planes should not be refurbished sooner rather than later with a reasonable business class product.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
And Air France has to keep the A380, of course. I mean, not just politically, but because it has routes like New York JFK, like Los Angeles, which are still incredibly high demand. And it makes much more sense for from a cost efficiency point of view to simply operate one A380 rather than two 777s. But one of the things that I find is really interesting here is if he's making Air France, from his position as an Air France KLM CEO, if he's making Air France go upmarket, what then happens to KLM? You may recall that I was talking to Utke de Jong from the Netherlands a few episodes ago, and one of the things that she was saying is that KLM feels very much like the slightly left behind stepchild of the Air France KLM group. So it'll be interesting to, and in many ways has had the stronger in-flight brand, stronger in-flight service, and certainly has had the better operational and profitability situation compared with Air France. So it'll be really interesting to see how Air France KLM, the wider group, plays these two airlines together, because for most routes in Europe, you have connectivity via either Paris or the Netherlands to where you're going. And it'll be really interesting to me whether or not they try and get a dual brand market segmentation strategy going. KLM, of course, on the aircraft has still quite a lot of the Collins Aerospace Diamond seating, which doesn't offer direct aisle access on a substantial portion of its fleet. It does have if it's got a number of outward-facing herringbones. I know it's got some cirrus, and I believe, but don't quote me on this, that it's also got some, or it's got or is taking some Jamco essential photocopies of cirrus. So it'll be really interesting to see how that evolves as well. Whether they're able to segment the markets, making Air France the premium carrier and KLM the, I don't want to say slightly less premium carrier, but certainly slightly less luxurious, more workmanlike and efficient, rather than quite so ooh-la-la with Air France. It'll be fascinating to see how Ben Smith works that. But I must say, I'm impressed that he's managed to get agreement with the flight attendant unions quite so quickly.
Yeah, that's right. I'm absolutely impressed as well, because it's really a hard job he took over there at Air France KLM, because he's the first foreigner, I think, to be at the head of the whole group. Normally it were they were always French guys, and I don't know. In the past, I said, everybody who wants to be the CEO of Air France KLM must be suicidaire, because of the French unions. They are so difficult.
Well, I mean, you remember when Air France executives had literally had their shirts ripped off trying to get to a meeting.
Yeah, absolutely.
It is very much the poison chalice. And I tell you, Gesha, when he you remember he did that he recorded that video to the staff of Air France when he arrived, and it was in French, but I feel like he could have used a little bit of French accent training. It was a little bit, bonjour, je m'appelle Ben Smith, le nouveau PDG de Air France KLM, which is all very well and good, and good on him for having a go. But I wasn't sure of the optics there. I wasn't sure whether that was going to be the, oh wait, he's too foreign Right. And I realize that I say this as the two of us in France as non-French people commenting on French aviation. But it's an interesting transition for Air France to be led by somebody who is not French.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think he's very courageous. And you know, as a non-French here, everybody in France tells me, "Oh, keep your accent." It's nice to have an accent. So I think he know he can well.
Hope he keeps his accent and indeed his shirts. Changing tack entirely and crossing the channel. Let's talk about drones. This was a fascinating, worrying, bizarre, very dark humor kind of situation. So London Gatwick just before Christmas, of course, was closed for days by reports of drones. After which, there were any number of reports about whether or not these drones in fact existed. Two poor people were arrested and subsequently named, and turned out to be entirely innocent. This was what a nightmare. Because we're in a situation where publicly available drones are not necessarily having to be registered, certainly not in the UK. There's a very limited number of ways that you can take down a drone. And it's that there is this existing need for further regulation. But in the meantime, it's kind of a wild west out there. Gesche, have you been following this drone situation? What's your take on it?
Yeah, but I think it this problems with drones, they will be more important everywhere in Europe, and you're absolutely right. There need to be more regulations, and maybe that people even flying small drones have to register. But till now, there are no plans for that. I think the new regulations in Europe, they don't ask people who own small drones to register for it. So I think they really have to work on this. And the other thing which I think about, well, like you said, it's very, very difficult to destroy the drones flying over airports because it's very limited. And apparently the systems to protect airports, they are very quite difficult as well. And then the next problem is also who will pay for the systems to protect airports from drones? Do we have to ask the governments of the different countries? Do we have to ask the airports themselves, or can they ask the airlines to participate because they are affected as well? So I think
Do
there are a
we
lot
need
of things.
the drone makers? Do we need a specific charge on drones to be redirected towards aviation safety and management of this problem?
I think so.
That seems to me a very logical situation. If you're not going to be able to for too much longer to avoid having this kind of situation where you've got to figure out something to do. Obviously the reports of these drones were. Indeed, the subsequent reports at Heathrow were that they were larger than your basic the thing that you might find under the holiday tree as a present. There's industrial sized drones that you might use for applications like photography or firefighting or similar. But it's very interesting to see just how cagey, certainly the UK was about saying exactly what its capabilities were in terms of anti-drone technology and tactics. And following the Heathrow situation, it's been interesting to see how the UK government has been very clear that it is not going to be the one paying for them, and it's not going to be the one that is deploying the military to airfields every few weeks or every few days. The thing that airports are private corporations and need to fund this themselves. So and that will be interesting for in a number of countries, both those where airports are privatized and where they are not. It'll be interesting to see in those countries where airports are not privatized but are state-run, even if a fully state-run company, whether the governments take a different tack in terms of protecting airspace against drones than in countries where there is where all or most of the airports are indeed privately owned. So yes, I'm not sure we've got any answers on this one, whether or not there were indeed drones, or whether or not people were engaged in some sort of bizarre mass hysteria that if anything else summed up the current world and cultural zeitgeist. It's a fascinating one, and it's something that I think we're all going to be encountering much more in 2019, not least because people now know that a medium to large sized drone can close an airport.
Yes, but on the other hand side, I can understand that they shut it down because the threat by drones is real. And
Oh, you don't want an
and I
airliner taking a
prefer
drone into an
to be
engine.
shut down than to have an accident with a plane and a drone. I mean,
No,
it's
absolutely. I mean, it was the right call in terms of safety. But I'm not sure what the actual solution is to this problem. And it'll be interesting to see. It'll be interesting to see what they look at in terms of making that better. Meanwhile, in the UK, Brexit appears to be going nowhere quickly. We are at a situation where we're, just over 70 days until the notional date where the United Kingdom leaves the European Union under its present legislation and present submission of Article 50, which is the legal instrument by which a country leaves the EU. Gesche, where do airlines stand at the moment in terms of both the very poorly received transitional deal that Theresa May is trying to push through Parliament, and indeed in the case of no deal Brexit?
I think they absolutely don't know, like everybody else. It's it's a complete uncertainty. Nobody knows what's going to happen, and that's horrible. And they need to know. I mean, they need to plan. Everybody needs to plan. It's the same for companies, for other companies than airlines.
I mean, we're well into the scheduling season at this point. So I think airlines have largely just said, well, we'll try to operate what we're scheduling. But that represents a huge risk for a number of airlines. There's in the notional withdrawal document, we've got situations where basically the everything's been copied across. But in the event of no deal Brexit, who knows? I can't, well, the number of times I've said I can't think that about something in Brexit and then it's gone ahead and happened. But I find it really difficult to think that there will not be some sort of pragmatic approach to aviation, if not to so many of the other, markedly more life-affecting situations like residency and so on for some 5, 6 million people who are caught up in this. Did you see Tom Enders in London recently, speaking about the impact to Airbus?
I wasn't there, but I read about it, and I know he pleaded again for an agreement with Brussels, that Great Britain should do an agreement, because he also says that it's horrible that this uncertainty over the terms of Brexit, and it's unbearable for ours. Yes, because they are very, very big in the UK. I think they are even the biggest aviation company maybe in the UK. Was I think they employ around 15,000 people, and they make all the wings for all the aircrafts from Airbus there. So it's really important, and they have to take their preparations. And if there will be no deal, then the competitiveness of the UK sites will be under threat.
Yeah.
And that will be a threat as well for the whole company. So.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, they've already spent, you know, even if nothing happens, they've spent tens of millions of euros at this point in terms of, you know, preparations. And that will only accelerate as we get closer and closer, you know, whether in terms of, you know, having the right number of parts to avoid shutdowns a bit, when the just-in-time deliveries can't occur and when, you know, customs borders are incurred. Yeah, it's very worrying. I mean, both for Airbus and for the UK. I mean, what's your take on whether Airbus would keep the wings in the UK after Brexit, or would it bring it to France, Germany, Spain, elsewhere in Europe?
It all depends on how the Brexit will affect the competitiveness, but I think it will be very difficult to organize all this,
yeah,
because all the wing production is there, and then I even can't guess how long it would take to transfer it to other sites.
Yeah.
So it could take, well, I don't know, at least some months till years.
Yeah.
So yeah. Well. Not in the beginning, but I think if maybe the competitiveness is really, 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 really damaged by the Brexit, the competitiveness of the UK sites, then maybe they in the long term they will think about something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, it would make sense. I mean, you have to, as a company, you have to look. Yes. At the competitiveness of your sites and where you produce, and
absolutely, and of course, you know, Brexit has other impacts. You know, IAG has been told very recently that it's it may face problems in terms of its ownership situation, where it's got, you know, European airlines in Iberia and Aer Lingus and Vueling, and then British Airways in the UK. There are direct human impacts, of course. UK passport holders travelling to Europe will, like any other third country national, now need passports with 6 months of validity. That's something that came out recently as one consequence. So people, you know, that's a direct personal issue, and that will, of course, impact on the passenger experience, as people aren't used to having to have that, and people will be turned away from flights because they haven't obeyed the regulations for third party nationals, and it's all just very uncertain still. You know, I can't believe that we don't have much more clarity now than when I talked to Tim Robinson of the Royal Aeronautical Society about Brexit in, you know, November 2017, you know, over a year ago. You know, we left that one with essentially a big throw up of our hands and shrug and say we have no idea what's going to happen, and we still don't. You know, we don't have a workable deal. No deal still seems like a terrible, terrible option. But I don't see anything, any other way out of it apart from, you know, that the UK has some sort of second referendum, and decides that this was all a terrible mistake and that the last 2 years have been an exercise in potential national suicide, and that we probably don't want to go ahead and do that. But it's all a bit of a nightmare.
But do you think it's possible to do a second referendum?
I do. And not just because personally I think it's always a good idea. You know, if you were going to, if you were buying a house and it turned out that the house was about to fall down and it wasn't in fact the idyllic rural retreat that your estate agents, Messrs. Johnson, Leadsom and Gove had sold you, you might have the opportunity to say, well, actually, do I really want to purchase this house after all? And I think on that principle, it makes a lot of sense to go back to the public with any deal, and to give them the opportunity now to say no. Actually, the pack of lies that we were sold has not in fact turned out to be anything but a pack of lies. You know, and the primary... Well, one of the primary campaigns broke electoral law And in many ways, there's an argument that that should invalidate the referendum and it should be rerun in any route. There's a significant amount of concern about the role of dark money in terms of political advertising, Facebook in particular. The work of Cambridge Analytica has also come under significant question. I think it's a reasonable thing to be looking at, but of course the clock is ticking. The UK government decided to make the clock tick, and so it is ticking. This would of course not be the first country to have had a referendum that said, yeah, we want to move away from the EU, and then the government went away, looked at it, and said, well, that's really difficult and disastrous. I mean, Switzerland had something very similar. The number of which treaty was it? The Lisbon Treaty, the number of countries that had referenda that said, oh, not entirely sure, and then the government said, well, this is what we think is the best way forward. I think, and indeed I hope that the UK will come to its senses, not just for aviation, but for the wider good of society, the wider good of Europe, and the wider good of the UK. But yes, I've been proved wrong before on this counts. Let's hope that it does not happen
Yeah,
again.
let's cross our fingers.
Indeed, indeed. And on that rather cheery note, that is it for today's conversation. We certainly hope you enjoyed it, listeners, and we're always keen to find out what you think. Please feel free to email me at john@runwaygirlnetwork.com with any suggestions. Thank you also to our guest, Gesche Wupper. Gesche, where can listeners find you and your work?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter as well as Gesche W, and then you can find my work on the internet sites of Die Welt, which is called WELT, and on Börsenzeitung, but that's behind a paywall. It's well, that's more difficult. It's Boersenzeitung. U-N-G. Well, wow,
Gesundheit,
what a long word. I'm sorry.
yes. But yeah, so if you're a subscriber to Börsenzeitung, then you'll already know Gesche's work, I'm sure. And as ever, you can find me on Twitter at ThatJohn, and everything from RGN on Twitter at RunwayGirl, and of course at runwaygirlnetwork.com. If you're enjoying these conversations, please leave a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts, and thanks for listening.